This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. His name is John Harriman. He was born in Lansing on New Year's Day 1900, and he's arguably Lansing's best forgotten writer. He was part of the famous expat American writers crowd in Paris in the 1920s. He called Ernest Hemingway a friend. His 1926 book, What Happens, was instantly banned as lewd and obscene. But Harriman's book is finally seeing the light of day. It's being published some 90 years after being banned. Sarah Kosiba is with us now. She's a biographer and she's an English professor at Troy University in Montgomery, Alabama. She's written the introduction for What Happens. Sarah, good to have you with us on Stateside.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Bill Castanier is here. Bill's vice president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thank you.
Sarah, what is the story that John Harriman is telling us in What Happens?
Well, it's pretty much a coming-of-age story. It's about a young man still in high school when we start the book and about sort of his experiences as a boy growing up in a small Midwestern city. It's a lot about sort of the dynamics of conversations between high school students. And then eventually Winfield, the main character, goes off to college. He works sort of side jobs in the summer, and we sort of, learn about his struggles in life, struggles in love, struggles with trying to realize what it is to sort of grow up and find his place in the world.
Tell us a little, Bill Castanier, about John Harriman's early years and about his family.
John Harriman came from a very wealthy family in Lansing, Michigan. His grandfather founded a company, John Harriman's Sons, which was a bespoke tailoring company that did work all over Michigan. They created suits for everyone from governors to W.F. Kellogg, the cereal maker. And so John grew up in an extended family that were very loving. But I think we can understand from some of his writing and some of the later correspondence he received from his parents that they were very strict and they had high regards for what he would and wouldn't do.
Hmm. And when did he realize he was called to be a writer?
I think it happened in the 1920s. From everything I can tell, obviously this is a very ongoing project. If anything, he perhaps started doing a little bit of writing when he was in college. There's evidence that some of his friends were members of sort of the literary magazine, the humor magazine at the University of Michigan. So he was surrounded by people even early on who were doing a lot of, I think, sort of writing and exploring those ideas. From what I've sort of been able to date in terms of his writing, What Happens was sort of written about 1924, so he was in Europe at the time. And so I think while he was over there, he was just, sort of saying, hey, I'm going to try this out for myself. And I think that very much became expanded when he met some of those expatriate writers in Paris, because that's what they were all doing.
Yeah, so
they were all writing and experimenting.
And there they were in Paris. And who were some of his friends and compatriots when he was there in Paris?
Well, he definitely met Ernest Hemingway there. I'm fairly certain he met William Carlos Williams when he was in Paris during that time. He met Josephine Herbst, who would eventually become his first wife. Robert McAlmon, who is more known even these days in literary circles for having been a publisher, but who was a writer unto his own right. Ford Madox Ford. A bunch of those writers that we really associate with that time period.
I'm kind of really interested in what it was that got What Happens banned. We know it starts right out with a young man in high school who gets together with the loose girl in the town, a girl nicknamed Tuffy. Not just kissing, but sex. And certainly that was very forward-thinking for that time in America, correct, Sarah?
It was. There were other sort of censorship issues around the time with some other publications, and particularly any that reference prostitution or issues along those lines. Obviously, especially during that time period, there was a high sense of sort of what morality should be and what we wanted to sort of publicly, endorse it as. And so a book like Harriman's sort of subverted some of that.
Who was it too much for? Were there censors in that day, the way films had censors? Who was it who went, no, we cannot publish this?
Well, oddly enough, in Harriman's case, it was the U.S. Customs Office, which was a little more unusual. part of the climate of the time was that because there was so much experimental writing going on in Paris and What Happens was originally published there, customs agents were actually sort of highly sensitive to anything that was coming in from particularly Paris and other countries. And so initially, I don't know exactly if someone opened the crate of books and started reading through it to make sure, or if they sort of just immediately seized it and said, oh, wait a minute, this is, you know, novels from Paris. They have to be scandalous. But it was accused of violating the 1922 Tariff Act, which banned the import of obscene material from other countries. And so it ended up being that basically Herman's battle was with the Treasury Department and trying to sort of get these books free from U.S. Customs, you know, more so than it was a battle even of publishers or anything.
Interesting. Before we talk about the obscenity trial and that battle, Sarah, would you kind of give us a sense of John Herman's writing and read us an excerpt from What Happens?
Yeah, his writing, the best sort of thing I would say, you know, especially because I don't want to sort of portray him as a lost Shakespeare, because I'm not sure that we're looking at necessarily someone who's going to revolutionize literature, but his writing was very honest and very realistic for the time, which fits in with a lot of what we know about that time period. And so What Happens was really praised for a lot of those qualities. So I'll read a little bit from the very first page of the novel. Winfield Payne was 17. His high school course was almost finished, but not quite. He wasn't in high school then. He was in Cleveland, working in an ice cream factory. They didn't tell him what they expected of him when they hired him. Nothing about the lifting of heavy blocks of ice back and forth, working all day long in a refrigerator. But he worked at it. He had to work at something. 5 days at it, and he looked like a ghost. Felt like one, too. Working in an icebox, carrying cakes of ice. No sweating to it, but plenty of hard work carrying heavy cakes of ice. God, this is the last one I can handle. But he went on with it into early July, just when work was at its hardest, in an ice cream factory. Sweets for the little children, 4th of July food. And he wasn't fitted for that kind of work. Should have been a salesman, could have been too, if he only half tried. But he was afraid to ask for a gentleman's job and didn't think that he could hold it if he ever landed it. But he couldn't hold this kind either. No boy could hold it. And he had to do something. Back home, a girl was walking the streets with a baby in her belly. Winfield's baby, she said. And what happened when girls have babies and boys are at fault? The boys go away sometimes and their parents wonder where they are. The boys are in Cleveland or someplace 200 miles away working in an ice cream factory.
That's Sarah Kosiba, who's a biographer and English professor at Troy University in Montgomery, Alabama, reading an excerpt from What Happens by Lansing-born writer John Herman. This book had been banned and had been not seen the light of day until 90 years later, when it is now being published. We have also have Bill Castanier with us, who's vice president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing. Tell us about the obscenity trial that resulted when What Happens was confiscated and banned.
Well, I think what's interesting, at least from my perspective about that obscenity trial, it is one of the first major obscenity trials in the United States. Obscenity had been banned for more than 100 years by that time by the federal government, also by most states. One of the things that John did is he was one of the first people to hire an attorney and fight it. And it's kind of remarkable for him. Now, it put him in terrible debt. But the person who defended him was Morris Ernst, who became very famous for being the co-founder of the American Civil Liberties Union. And he later went on to defend another very famous book, Ulysses Against Obscenity Charges, which he won. Mm. He did not win his first case, which was John's, for What Happened, but he won his second one for Ulysses. One of the things that John did, which I thought was interesting, is his attorney arranged to have a psychologist come in and say that basically this book would have no impact on young adults. This is who they are. And the second thing he did is he had a number of authors write sort of letters for him supporting his effort, and the judge wouldn't allow those to be read or brought into evidence. But it was a very quick trial. I think it was only one day, and it was deemed obscene and destroyed. Hmm. It's my feeling is that kind of hung with him his whole life. As anybody that writes knows, that when something that terrible happens to your first book, it kind of leaves a scar on you, and it takes a while to write that second book.
And Sarah Kosiba, tell us about John Herman's writing. What happened after What Happens was suppressed?
Well, he continued to write. He published, predominantly in a lot of small magazines, artsy poetry magazines and little magazines of the time. His second novel didn't appear until 1932, but there's evidence that actually he had written that novel as early as sort of 1928 or 1929 and couldn't find a publisher until 1932, which was likely in many cases because he had such difficulties with the first novel to some degree. So he didn't have that reputation sort of built up that would have made it easier for him to sort of continue.
Bill, his life after this episode, it would have made a great movie. I mean, it involved kind of an espionage, and he served in the Coast Guard in World War II.
He was every man. he seemed to touch on bits and pieces of American history from the Paris Lost Generation all the way through the Beat Generation in Mexico, because he bookended that with after he moved to Mexico. Some say flee, because he was sort of under investigation for some of the things that he had done as a communist, relating to the Communist Party. He was involved in the HUAC hearings, so that's another kind of like iconic era of American history. But then he divorced Josephine before that and married another woman, and they moved to Mexico, where he hooked up with the likes of William Burroughs. It was alleged that he was at the death of William Burroughs' wife when William Burroughs shot his wife reenacting the William Tell Overture and missed. That may be more myth than reality, though.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that Sarah is finding out. There's a lot of myths.
Did he start out to be a radical, or did this just kind of evolve? Or did the banning of his book kind of set him on that course, Sarah?
Well, the issue is that, especially during the Depression, considering the conditions in this country, so many people, particularly writers and artists, really had a huge amount of empathy for the people who were struggling. And I think that's really where his more radical ideas started. During the sort of late 1920s, early 1930s, he was living in rural Pennsylvania quite a bit of the time. And he got to know the local farmers and I think developed a sympathy for the conditions that they were undergoing. And so eventually his work with the farmers, protesting those conditions, advocating for better situations for them, just continued to grow. And there's evidence in the late 1930s, early 1940s, that he was organizing streetcar workers in New Orleans. And so I think he really just had sort of the working class in his heart to a great degree and was sympathetic to the concerns that they had.
And interesting to think he grew up in such a moneyed, privileged family in Lansing.
Yeah, and actually he comments on that in some letters from time to time, that not only did his parents not always agree with his politics, but that they sort of represented a class of people that were sort of out of touch with the people he was trying to help.
Mm. Sarah, where do you think, as a scholar, as an English professor, where does John Herman and what happens? Where do both belong in American literary history?
I think they definitely should be part of our discussions of the 1920s literature of the time, both for some aspects of the experimentalism, in his language that he uses in the novel, in terms of the literary climate of the time. The obscenity trial that the book went through is very indicative of what a lot of writers were struggling with then, in terms of trying to be honest, trying to write reality, and sort of fighting against this more overarching sense of morality that was, we were attempting to promote. And I think that it really presents an interesting insight into youth culture in the 1920s. I mean, we think back, and a lot of times that era is so iconic for the flapper and
yes,
and for the jazz age. There are aspects of that in here. I think even it refers at one point in time sort of to the kind of girls who, would be part of that scene. But he's also talking about ordinary high school students. And I think that that's something, too, that sometimes we romanticize that age without necessarily looking at the reality. And I think there's something valuable about that.
And I think when we look back in our minds, we rather desexualize the experience of growing up in that era. And certainly they had the same urges and the same kinds of desires and things churning inside of them as kids today do.
Well, and that's one of the things that I find particularly interesting, exactly, that I think we look back at that time and we think that it was so much more prim and proper. And here we see a novel like Herman's who lays out the idea that back then high school students were having sex. And, I mean, that's an issue we still debate today in terms of, how to prevent it or how to deal with these situations when they occur. And so, I mean, I think it shows a continuity of sort of social problems and social issues that mm-hmm. extend far more back, back further than we're, familiar with quite often.
Bill Castanier, does John Herman have any family left in the Lansing area?
He does. As a matter of fact, we're in close communication with his niece. Her name is Susan Brewster. She provided us with a number of photographs that have never been seen or published that are of John and Josephine and one of his family members. And they were taken at Petoskey and Bayview in northern Michigan, where that was kind of the connection for him and Hemingway, I think, in Paris. Both families had cottages at Walloon Lake for a time. And I think if Herman did not know Hemingway at that time, their families certainly knew each other. And, of course, later there are connections that we know of. I think that's an interesting part of what makes this another reason this book should be studied, is because Hemingway and Herman both came from this North Woods sort of aspect of their lives and wrote about it.
Bill, tell us about this event, June 11th, that's going to celebrate the release of What Happened, where it finally sees the light of day after some 89 years.
Well, the Historical Society of Greater Lansing, we're always looking for something unusual and different about history, because that makes it come to life for people. We're going to have a book release party, which he was due 89 years ago, and I really do believe it could have made a difference in the trajectory of his life. Not that there was something wrong with his life, but I think he could have been a literary star.
Yeah, so. He definitely had a lot of potential. I mean, I think had this book come out, instead of sort of fading away into literary history, I think he would have definitely been recognized a lot more.
And I think, Sarah, I can sense that you certainly hope that releasing this novel, What Happens, will boost the reputation, literary reputation, and the public awareness of John Herman.
The public awareness, and also expand our awareness of regional literature. I mean, there's a lot of great Michigan writers that are out there, but I mean, here's a Michigan writer who's talked about a lot of places and a lot of people and a lot of times that I think are still really relevant to the history of not only Lansing, but the state. And so between, hopefully some of the momentum that builds from something like the publication of What Happens may lead to the republication of some of his later novels. Summer Has Ended, the 1932 novel, much of it is set in Detroit and in Upper Michigan. I think that adds a lot to what we know about the state and about our sense of history of those times.
And once again, the event to celebrate the release of this 1926 banned book, What Happens, will take place this Thursday in Lansing. For details, go to lansinghistory.org. You'll have a chance to meet and talk with Sarah Kosiba, who's a biographer and English professor at Troy University in Montgomery, Alabama. She, of course, has written the introduction for John Herman's book, What Happens. And Bill Castanier will be there. He's vice president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing. Thanks so much to both of you for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.